You're listening to TIP.
On today's episode, we bring back fan favorite Chris Mayer. Chris is the author of the very popular book, 100 Baggers, and the co-founder and portfolio manager of Woodlock House Family Capital. This is Chris's third time coming onto the podcast. Because of Chris's book, his great blog, and the appearances he's done on various podcasts like the one you're listening to, he's inspired thousands of people to recognize the power of long-term compounding in the stock market. During this episode, Chris and I chat about the power of long-term compounding by investing in very high-quality businesses, as well as a few of his holdings, including Constellation Software, Topicus.com, and Lumine. I did a deep dive on Constellation Software back on episode 531 last year, and Mark Leonard, the president and founder, is a great case study of an amazing capital allocator. From a high level, Constellation is a conglomerate that continually acquires very small, vertical market software businesses and historically has had a return on invested capital of roughly 25%. Constellation has been one of the best performing stocks on the market as it's been a 200 bagger since the IPO in 2006. During this chat, we also touch on a review of how Chris's fund performed in 2023, where Chris focuses much of his attention in managing a fund, how Chris first discovered Constellation Software, how Constellation 2.0 has developed in recent years, why Constellation has started performing spinoffs, and why Chris invested in both Topicus and Lumine, why Topicus is targeting higher organic growth rates in their subsidiaries, Chris's thoughts on the valuations of these businesses, how Chris would consider allocating fresh capital today in his fund, and much more. Chris was too humble to say it, but his fund achieved a 45% annual return before fees in 2023, which vastly outperforms the market return of only 24%. I've personally deeply resonated with Chris's approach to investing in the stock market, as I believe it not only works well, but also allows you to sort of set it and forget it once you get to know a great business very well, and then monitor its performance over time. We recently started our TIP Mastermind community, and I've been quite surprised by the number of people in our audience who have also came to the same conclusion as me as to how they want to invest in stocks. In the Mastermind community, we talk stocks and network with like-minded investors, so if this is something you'd be interested in, you can click the link in the show notes to learn more, or simply go to theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. With that, sit back and relax as I bring you today's episode with Chris Mayer.
Celebrating 10 years and more than 150 million downloads. You are listening to the Investors Podcast Network. Since 2014, we studied the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected. Now, for your host, Clay Fink.
Welcome to the Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Clay Fink, and today I'm thrilled to bring back Chris Mayer. Chris, it's always great chatting with you on the show.
Yeah, great to be back with you, Clay. It's going to be a good one, I think.
During this episode, I wanted to particularly talk about Constellation Software, Topicus, and Lumine. But before we get to that, Chris, I just want to start this by just saying congratulations. You shared with your audience that you had your best annual return since you started your fund in 2023. You had your best returns in 2023 since you started your fund, and you managed not to sell any of your holdings during the year. And I think back to our last chat, you had mentioned you only sold one holding in 2022. So making progress on the little you had left to go. And I don't think too many fund managers can say that they had zero turnover throughout a year. So I just really admire your ability to stick with the names you find and give them plenty of room to run. So you can take this in any direction you'd like, but I just wanted to give you an opportunity to share some of your thoughts and reflections from 2023.
Yeah, I mean, 2023, you know you're having a good year when your worst performer is up 19% for the year. That was Heiko A, but I had a couple that were up about 80%. I'm Technion and Lumine, which we'll talk about later, were both big winners. You know, I think Copart was up 60%. Constellation, which we're going to talk about, was up about 60%, I think. And these are all, you know, big chunky positions. I run a concentrated fund. So it's just everything really came together. And I've owned all these positions for a while. And it's just, it's nice to see that. Other than that, I would say, I didn't sell anything, which was interesting. And I didn't, I had some inflows. So I had some chances to do some things. And I had really two moves during the year that I made, and they were both very impactful. One was adding a lot to Lumine, which again, we'll talk about. And then also adding a lot to Technion when I had the chance. So those two worked out well. I mean, the other thing that's always I like to do is you go back and look at the high and low and the differences. And, last year it was typical, even though it was a very strong year, that the difference between highs and lows in a lot of names was quite wide, 50% or more. And it wasn't like it was just a straight line up through the year. I mean, I remember in October, I had maybe two or three positions that were negative for the year. I think maybe, I can't remember specifically. I think LIFCO might have been one of those that was actually down year to date at one point and wound up finishing, plus 40 or something. So it's the lesson we get every year, which is there's lots of opportunities, even just within a year, if you're patient with these things. And maybe the last thing I'll say about 2023 was it was another year where the market serves us some humble pie as far as macro forecasting goes. I mean, how much talk we had about there being recession, slowdown. And even if you knew the results ahead of time, I'll take Old Dominion, which is a company I have in the portfolio, LTL trucking company. If you knew what 2023 looked like, if I gave you the financials ahead of time, you would have seen a decline in revenues and a decline in earnings per share for the year. You would for sure not thought that the stock would be up 43%, which is what it was. So, again, just it's difficult to forecast on those kinds of macro variables. And that's why I like to just stick with, really good companies that I know well and that are compounding capital at high rates, and otherwise sit back and let them do their thing.
It's funny when I look back over the past few years, some of the narratives or best love ideas you have to overcome, as Munger says. And there are two that come to mind that, just starting out as a newer investor and just developing over time and overcoming some of these narratives, there are two that sort of stick out to me. The first is that markets are mostly driven by the Fed. It's sort of a narrative. I've heard some people tell me that, there's no use trying to pick individual companies because the Fed essentially just drives the entire market. And the second one I wanted to mention is that you need to own FANG stocks. I mean, this is essentially developed to be the Magnificent Seven with the addition of, I think, NVIDIA and Tesla. You need to own these stocks in order to do well as an investor, maybe even outperform the market. As you mentioned, 2022, Fed raised rates. Many people were worried about a market crash, market correction, and stocks overall were down. But if you look at a lot of these great businesses, a lot of businesses that you own, the drawdowns, you could argue, weren't really justified if you look at the actual business performance in 2022, 2023. So investors who were patient saw that opportunity, ended up being rewarded handsomely, like you were in 2023 with your, one of your holdings being up over 60%. And it's sort of ironic how, with the benefit of hindsight, what many people saw as bad things happening, all this uncertainty being around, actually ended up being a blessing. And I remember actually one of your old tweets, you posted that you had added to Technion in late 2022 and you shared the multiple and it was like a 17. And, from that purchase, you've got 100% appreciation just from the multiple expansion. So it's quite interesting to think about how, this noise in the markets can really keep people out of it, wait for things to become more clear. So could you talk more about that, distinguishing that signal and noise?
Yeah, I mean, that's important to do. I think, one thing I do is I don't spend time on that macro sort of guesswork. So, I mean, I can't tell you how many times someone has sent me, some kind of think piece about something or other. And, I politely thank them and then I put that in the delete pile. I don't spend any time on that. I spend more time on my names. I mean, last year I met with several CEOs and of course, then I spend time looking at new ideas, which is always fun. And so it's really where you put your attention. I really guard that attention carefully. If you allow yourself to, read into these narratives that people create, then it makes it more difficult to make a good decision, I think. Another thing is just kind of habits. It's taken a long time, but I don't log into my account every day. I try not to look at stock prices during the day. I usually will check in the morning, see what's going on, and then I look again at the close. But even that's probably too much. For most people, I don't think they should probably be looking at it every day. So, I think another key part of distinguishing the noise from the real signals is if you spend time on the businesses that you own and really try to drill down on what the essentials, figure out what really will matter for this business over the next, say, 10 years. And when you make that your filter, you know, what are the critical success points for this thing over the next 10 years? What has to happen? A lot of these other details sort of dissolve. Talks about whether there might be a recession next year. It doesn't become very important because, again, you're thinking way out. You're thinking 10 years and you're going to own it through a recession or two, you know? And so I spent a lot of time on that, figuring out what are the essential pieces of a business that will help it succeed, and identifying that and then really staying focused on that.
And again, mentioning the Magnificent Seven and the FANG, it's probably been like over 100 times now. I've seen a chart where it shows the Magnificent Seven performance being way up. And then after you take those companies out of the S&P, it's just like a flat or it's like a downside. So it kind of gives this illusion to where, you know, there's only a handful of companies that deliver returns in the market, but there's plenty of names out there. But when you put some of these great companies in with all these, you know, just straight up bad companies or poor performers, you know, it sort of hides them.
Yeah. I mean, this is another thing why I even hesitate to talk too much about like the market, because people will talk about the market as if it's just sort of one thing. But of course, when you look within it, there's huge variations. Even just looking at the S&P 500, as you mentioned, there's huge variations within it. So you have to be careful about that. And then when you throw in overseas markets, I mean, there's a lot of diversity, a lot of stuff going on.
I'm also reminded, I just recently shared a book review on Willis Johnson's book, Junk to Gold. And I mentioned during that episode that over the last 30 years, there's a chart that was shared that showed the top performers over the past 30 years. Copart came in at number 14. And I think so many people would be surprised that Copart did better than, you know, companies like Google and Amazon. You know, just kind of like it like defies what you would really think about, how like you'd think like the Amazons of the world would be like by far the best performers, but there's these regular everyday type companies that, you know, just show up every day, compound.
Yeah, I love those kind of lists, because those are, you know, because you always find lots of names like that. I mean, if you look at the last 20 years or so, Old Dominion shows up there as well, way up there, and you're just like, wow, you know, this little humble trucking company has been that much a performer. I know like Monster Beverage, I think, was actually the number one performing stock over the last, maybe it was 20 or 30 years. I forget what the metric was. But again, it's a little bit shocking because, you know, you see this mix of business and you're right. You expect it to be dominated by the Amazons and Googles and Microsoft, but there's lots of pretty humble businesses in there that just compound at high rates for a long time.
All right. So let's turn here to Constellation Software. Most in our audience are going to be aware of this company. And if you're listening and you're not quite as aware as what this company does, I did a deep dive on it and a deep dive on Mark Leonard's wonderful letters back on episode 531. So you might go back and reference that. And I have to give a thank you to Chris for putting this company on my radar last year. How about we started off by just talking about how you discovered this company and how long it really took you to coming around to really understanding its long-term potential?
Yep, that's a good question. I'm not sure exactly when. I'm going to guess it was somewhere around maybe, I don't know, somewhere around, say, 2016 or so. And I remember being skeptical of it for a long, long while. It took years. I knew of it, but I didn't bother looking into it because I had such a bias at that time against a super acquisitive company like that. And it was buying software companies. And I think the kind of a common area of doubt around it was, well, I guess I remember this was my thought, is they just must be buying a bunch of junky software companies and you know, has no terminal value. And these things are all going to eventually be zeros. And they're just, you know, going to keep running faster and faster to keep it going. And I didn't really spend a lot of time on it for several years. So I would say it was probably around maybe 2019 where I got more serious and I actually sat down and read Mark Leonard's letters. And then I was like, wow, you know, this is worth digging into more. And so, I started to do a lot more work then, and shortly after became shareholder in my fund.
When I released that episode I mentioned last year and purchased my first shares, the share price was around 2,300 Canadian dollars. And at the time I was thinking, hey, I'm paying up for quality. And now here we're sitting today, February 2024, share price is north of 3,700 Canadian dollars. So over the past year alone, share prices are up nearly 60%. And that's quite high for a company like Constellation, where it's compounding consistently at the 25% range. And I just like to get your thoughts on the recent run up, because it's easy to think, you know, it's just a company that was overpriced is now more overpriced. Maybe there's some developments within Constellation that potentially warrant such an increase over the past year.
Well, I would say the big thing is I think the market has come around to the idea that Constellation has found another gear when it comes to deploying capital. So if you look at, you know, 2018, 2019, 2020, those years, they were probably spending $500-600 million in acquisitions deploying capital. And then it's really kicked up in recent years. It did, you know, $1.5 billion, I think it was, in 2021, and 2022 is similar. And then, you know, the results we have through three quarters of last year, they were over $2 billion in capital deployed. So you're already through three quarters of a year last year, they're already, you know, three or four times more what they did in a full year just a few years ago. And so, you know, the market knows that Constellation is deploying capital at, you know, high rates. And so when they deploy that much capital, it's going to be some nice growth in free cash flow. So I think that's the big one. And I think there was a narrative that started a little bit that, you know, they were butting up against the limits of what they could do. And then, you know, they've just been able to put together some pretty attractive larger deals. I mean, the one last year was with Optimal Blue, where they bought a business for $700 million and they paid $200 million up front, and they get a note for the $500 million that doesn't pay. They don't have to pay any interest in it for 5 years. And it's like, wow, you know, how did you come up with that idea? And that was a business that, you know, they bought it as complicated. It's part of a transaction. Black Knight is merging with Intercontinental Exchange, and they had to ditch this thing. So it was kind of like a really motivated seller, and Constellation stepped in and bought it. And this was a business that Black Knight had bought for a valuation of like $1.8 billion in 2020. And then they bought another piece of it in 2022, where it was, I think it was like $2.8 billion, let's say, something like that. And here's Constellation swooping in, buying it for $700 million with those kind of deals. So now I think, you know, the market's starting to think that, yeah, Constellation's got lots of room to deploy capital still, and we'll figure out ways to put it to work. So that's one. And then the other thing, I think that, you know, the other key part of Constellation is the organic growth rate. And I think that's been pretty strong. I think it's maybe even surprised a lot of people. It's been running about 5 or 6% all year, even better if you look at kind of the core maintenance and recurring. So I think the combination of those things together, you've got, you know, rocket fuel. So yeah, I'm really excited to see what they do next.
So with regards to the Optimal Blue deal, if I am understanding correctly, they put down around $200 million. The purchase price is around $700 million. And this seems to be a case where their return on capital isn't going to be, you know, what they typically target, like a 30% range. It sounds like it's going to be a lot higher in this case.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, it seems like it. I don't know. We'll have to, you know, still kind of early. So, I mean, the usual rule of thumb is as deals get bigger, you know, your IRR comes down, which I think is okay in Constellation's case, because like you mentioned, they were doing 30. And now if they do 25 or 20, but can deploy a whole lot more capital doing that, I think that's still creating a tremendous amount of value. So, yeah, we'll have to see what, you know, the specifics of that, of the Optimal Blue deal are. But yeah, I'm pretty optimistic that they're going to do pretty well in that. I mean, it's hard to not do well when you only put $200 million down for a business of that size, probably generating, you know, $100 million in profits.
Over the years, I think a lot of people assume that the competitive landscape is going to get quite overwhelming for Constellation. Have you seen that intensify over the years since you've started researching it or first owned it?
Yes, I would say yes. There's certainly been a lot more copycats. And, you know, in practice, as a firm has done some good work on this, and they identified at the time of their report, which I think was last year, something like 34 private VMS consolidators. So it's quite a bit. But one thing that's interesting is that, you know, they are trying to copy Constellation, and they're trying. But when you look at the deals, there is still quite a bit of difference. So, for example, Constellation's average deal, you know, they're buying a company at like 1x sales. These are very the smaller deals I'm talking about now. You know, they may buy something, let's say, around $3 million in revenue, and their organic growth is like zero, you know, very, very little. But when you look at the private consolidators and the type of deals they're doing, they are larger, 2 to 3 times larger typically, and they have a lot more organic growth. So they're playing a little bit of a different game. A lot of them, they're also, you know, because they're also leveraging up a little more. So I would say, yes, there's more competition, but with kind of the niche that Constellation is in, I don't know that they still have that much competition on those small things. So it's kind of weird. You know, I would say, yes, there's more competition, but there's still interesting nuances, and it seems like there's plenty of room to deploy capital still.
And since they're getting such attractive returns on these deals, I'm sure many of these companies have options in terms of who they want to sell to. What do you think the main motivation is for them wanting to select Constellation, given the attractive purchase price that Constellation is getting?
Yes. So this is something I had to spend some time on to get convinced of. But, you know, there is some value in the idea that Constellation is a permanent home for these businesses, that they're not going to, you know, fold it and lay off everyone or, you know, kill the business or whatever. I mean, the owners who sell these businesses, if your goal is to sell for the top dollar, then Constellation is not likely going to be your buyer. But if you're more concerned about, you know, you want to have a home for your business there, then that's where Constellation has an advantage. I know that, and a lot of people are going to be skeptical about that, but I've talked to enough people to know that that is part of it. So yeah, I mean, other than that, again, Constellation is still, you know, you are dealing with businesses where they're not, there's not a whole lot of competition for some of these, where there's not a lot of organic growth and or no organic growth. So Constellation may still be the best option there in those cases.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Kyle, you're connected with a ton of different investors and portfolio managers, and you're just really in the know on a lot of these things. How do you keep up with all the day-to-day headlines for your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so I used to have a ton of issues with this, and that was until I started using Yahoo Finance.
Really? What's so great about it?
So Yahoo Finance is awesome. I have my whole portfolio entered and I can easily see all the top headlines to keep up with the recent news. And each day you get an overview of the major global events that might be moving the market. So I'm ready to easily pounce on any opportunities that come my way.
What else can you do on Yahoo Finance's platform?
They also have a number of cool features, including a tool that lets you link all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts.
Well, now I know that the audience is really going to love this one. And I actually see they have 90 million monthly active users.
For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com.
The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
And many people speak to the decentralization aspect of the Constellation business model. It really helps them scale their acquisitions over time as many different people are making these acquisitions within the holding company. It gives each business the autonomy to make the decisions they feel is best for them. And it helps keep the corporate bureaucracy that Leonard wrote about in his letters. He mentioned how corporate bureaucracy tends to creep up in businesses as they grow. But I think as with most things in life, there's no free lunch. What do you believe are some of the drawbacks to decentralization?
Well, first, yeah, you're right. I mean, the decentralization has been kind of been a key thing. I think it was Larry Cunningham who said that the genius in CSI was that the people coming up with solutions to the problems were the ones who were closest to the problems, which I liked the way that was put. And they do have this culture of sharing knowledge, so it works really well for them. Drawbacks, I would say, well, first, it might be worth pointing out that they're not all decentralized. Like Lumine is not decentralized. They have a centralized M&A team that work together in Toronto with David Nyland. So I have heard that this is not necessarily, you know, I guess you could say it's decentralized because Lumine is making their own decisions rather than Constellation in HQ. I would say the biggest drawback talking to people is it seems to be perhaps around, keeping your team together. there may be some thought that that retaining people that are, you know, flung out all over the place is harder than when you're all working together. I've heard that. There might also be, you know, you might lose something by not having, you know, a closely knit team that works together versus teams that are spread out all over. But some of that is, you know, by design. I mean, I think Constellation attracts a sort of person. And, you know, for example, if you want to get rich very quickly, probably Constellation is not going to be a place you're going to stay very long. So I would say, it's hard to say because they're so good at it. So, you know, what's the drawbacks for them specifically? I don't know that there's too many other than perhaps there's something to this that there may be some difficulty in retaining people. But, you know, again, part of that is by design and they seem to have managed through it pretty well.
Yeah. And since I mentioned decentralization being a key aspect of Constellation as they continue to grow overall, senior managers within Constellation are required to invest anywhere between, I think, 25 to 75% of their bonus into shares of Constellation. So there's a lot of skin in the game within these managers and a lot of an incentive to act in the best interest of shareholders. But as they grow, each senior manager has less of an impact on the overall performance of the conglomerate. And I could see that making some managers maybe a bit frustrated over time. I'm curious if this is a concern from your perspective.
Yeah, I think it's a concern from like the comp perspective, like in its compensation. If what you do has your compensation is tied more toward the overall, then that could be a problem. But I think that Constellation spends a lot of time thinking about this. Mark Leonard certainly has mentioned it. You know, this is the biggest challenge with them getting so large is how do you incentivize teams and keep it so that what they do, they still have a big impact and can still do well for themselves. So yeah, that's something to always keep an eye on. And that's kind of where the experiments with the spinoffs are interesting too. There's ways to harness incentives a little differently there. So definitely something to keep an eye on.
It also reminds me, Leonard, historically, he's shown that he tries to talk the share price down at times. And I think back, well, shares of Constellation have gone up 60% over last year. So how many of these managers want to say, hey, I want to put a significant portion of my income into shares of Constellation? I'm sure there's other things they might want to do with their compensation.
Yeah, I've heard people say that, you know, those concerns are voiced, you know, Mark Leonard and the senior execs basically have this line where they tell them that, you know, it evens out over the long run. And, you know, it's kind of think more like dollar cost averaging, sort of. So, so far, you know, it's worked very, very well because I'm sure there's lots of times, I mean, even recent years, you know, me owning it in my fund, how many times people have told me it's expensive. So far, it's worked out.
In Leonard's 2021 letter, he started to talk about what we can call Constellation 2.0, where Constellation starts to reinvent themselves. In that letter, he talked about how they needed to create new avenues to deploy capital. For those not familiar, their typical deal is around the $5 million purchase price. And just as a business scales up, you can only do that for so long. And he mentioned two ways or two avenues they could go down to reinvent themselves. The first of which was simply doing these bigger deals, for example, the Blue Optimal deal you mentioned. And then the second way is to start venturing outside of the VMS space and start looking at new verticals, new industries. Maybe you could talk about how this has developed. Leonard wrote that letter in 2021, and it's been a few years since then, and take that whatever direction you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, among Constellation shareholders, this is the talk, like what's Constellation 2.0 look like? And I think we've gotten a preview last year. We've seen them deploy bigger deals and do bigger deals, more complex deals. You know, will they drift outside of EMS? I mean, I think they've already done it to a degree. I mean, I talk to people, former CSI people, and they already own companies that are not really true, you know, old VMS. They have some HMS. They have some that are more service oriented. So I think in some ways they have crept a little more into adjacent software. And then I think it was in that last letter where he wrote about how they looked at a deal, came close to doing a deal that was oil and gas related, and where the motivation was more taxes or something like that. I'm sure it would have been, you know, a really interesting deal, but that was, you know, that was certainly something beyond VMS. So yes, I would say you have to be comfortable with this potential drift to be a shareholder today, because I think that they will eventually do something outside of VMS in maybe a bigger way. And part of that, I mean, you just have to, you know, given that a long track record, thoughtful capital allocation, you know, I feel pretty good. It's not going to be something dumb that we're going to wake up and go, gosh, why'd they do that? You know, so yeah, I'm really interested to see what they did. And they may not find anything. It may just be that Constellation 2.0 is what we see today, which is that they still do these little tiny VMS deals, but they're also deploying sizable amounts of capital in things like Optimal Blue Deal and other things like that.
In terms of the runway and continuing to scale up the business, one of the parts that has been or is difficult for me to wrap my mind around is when I hear people say there's a database of 100,000 potential companies that they could acquire. It's like, you know, there's only so many markets, there's only so many niches that can be addressed, but 100,000? So it almost sounds too good to be true. So could you talk about how it's possible that the database is that large?
Yeah, I remember when I first heard the 100,000 number, I was surprised too, but then I kept hearing it from different people who, you know, used to work at CSI. They'd keep putting that number. One person even said it was 200,000. I don't know, but it's a big number. And when you know, they acquired what was 100 companies in 2022 or so, suddenly it puts that all in perspective. You know, there's a lot. And part of it is, you know, there are new companies being added to that pool all the time too. So it's new software companies being created all the time, do all kinds of things. And I agree. I mean, it seems like it's a huge number, but I mean, it's real. I think about, you know, for every different business, there are potentially, who knows, you know, how many different potential software packages for that business. When you start to think about it across all kinds of geographies, it's a big number.
So Constellation has spun off two different businesses into public companies, Topicus.com, which we'll refer to as Topicus, and Lumine, both holdings in your fund as well. Topicus was spun off in 2021. And Lumine was spun off in 2023. And since you are an owner of Constellation, you had these shares deposited into your account, which is a quite interesting dynamic how, you know, you have this great performing stock and it just starts depositing these new companies in your account.
That's right. You know, that reminds me, when we talk about Constellation's gain, you know, sometimes you have to include the spinoffs in there. It's even better.
Right. So maybe you could just talk about why they ventured into doing these spinoffs and how they're value accretive to Constellation shareholders.
Well, I mean, I think in Topicus' case, you know, it was an experiment, partly an experiment with incentives like we talked about before. I think it was a natural there because Constellation also didn't own 100% of it anyway. The seller still owned a large block, so it was kind of a natural. And my understanding is that they were kind of their own little castle over there anyway. But I keep hearing people refer to it as an experiment and to see if, you know, what Constellation might learn. There are some differences. Topicus' organic growth rate, for example, is higher, has traditionally been higher. And so I think that's part of the motivation with Topicus. And with Lumine, maybe it was a little different because Lumine is more is tied to one vertical, media and communications. And that spinoff came off a transaction they did with Wide Orbit, pretty sizable transaction for that group. And it allowed the owners of Wide Orbit to kind of roll over their shares into this thing and probably made the purchase price work there. So I think I've also heard that it's Lumine was an experiment in a way for David Nyland to kind of run his own thing. He's the CEO of Lumine and he wanted to do that. So those are some of the reasons I've heard. But there are interesting differences, and it'll be interesting to see how they kind of play out over the next 5-10 years, because Topicus can go across any vertical, but they're more supposed to be confined to Europe. And then Lumine is confined to one vertical, but they could go anywhere. So you have two different wrinkles there and how those play out.
So if Topicus is confined to Europe, does that mean Constellation isn't going shopping in that market?
I think they can still do that. I mean, they have, the way Constellation's database works, my understanding is that if you have a certain target and you're in contact with that group regularly, it stays. It can't be poached by another group. But if you did lose contact with it, and I think contact means having a meaningful conversation within a year, then it's open for anyone. I think Topicus has advantages in Europe because they're actually there and there's intricacies about that market. You know, there's different rules and regulations for different European countries. There's different languages. And so I think Topicus has an advantage there, but I don't think that it means Constellation can't do deals in Europe. Same with Lumine. I mean, when I talked to, you know, David Nyland about it, he's, you know, pretty confident that he's got a good lock on media and communications, you know, that industry. But I suppose if another CSI group had a media and communications deal and they sourced themselves, then they can do that.
Yeah, and from my understanding, Constellation still owns, you know, a portion of Topicus in Lumi. It's not like they completely sold it off. So it seems to me that these spinoffs are sort of a tool for Constellation and sort of a special situation type deal where it helps them make a certain type of acquisition, make the deal still work, you know, make everyone happy. And, you know, for example, that CEO wanting his own company to manage. So it seems more so like it's not so much a strategic play where they're trying to arbitrage the public markets or do something to that extent. It's more so a very, very special situation type.
Special situations, yes. And I think in the future, we will see more spinoffs. I mean, when I've talked to people there, yes, and it's unequivocal, there will be more spinoffs. It's just kind of, you know, what it will look like. I think it will look more like Lumine. It will be those kinds of spinoffs. It'll be part of a larger deal, and that will be the natural time to spin off something by itself. That's what I suspect. And I think Jamal, the CFO at Constellation, may have said this at some point, that they're not likely to just take, like, you know, Harris and spin it off as its own, one of this operating groups, and just spin it off on its own. It's more likely to be a specific vertical. And my guess is that it will be a specific vertical in conjunction with some kind of larger transaction like with Lumine. That's my guess.
One aspect I particularly find interesting with these spinoffs is that it can actually lead to pretty good investment opportunities from the aspect that institutions that own Constellation, they get these other shares deposited. And just because of their mandates, they can't hold Lumine or they can't hold Topicus. So they don't even care about the price. They're just selling it. And it can lead to the situation where you have four sellers. It overwhelms the market with sell pressure and gives long-term investors a pretty good opportunity in terms of the entry point too.
I think with Constellation, it's maybe a little different because Constellation shareholders, I think it's a little different. Like with Topicus, I don't think you saw a lot of that dumping early. And you can see it in like the volume. I remember doing this. The numbers might be wrong, but I did this at the time. When you looked at like the first 10 days of trading at Topicus, maybe it was like 15% of the shares traded of those shares turned over. So a lot of Constellation shareholders kept it. And because Topicus was pretty sizable, even out of the gate. But Lumine, it was different. Lumine, it was like more than 50% of the shares traded hands in those first 10 days because it was a lot smaller. And so I think even some of the large, you know, Constellation shareholders were just dumping it because it was just too tiny, it's too small. So I think that plays into it. You have a little bit of different dynamic that way, which makes it interesting. And with Topicus, you know, that was in 2021. I think it spun off in February. And if you remember 2021, I mean, you know, software and tech and stuff it was a very kind of a little bit frothy. And so I think that stock got kind of caught up in that wave. I held it the whole time through. So I rode it all the way up. I remember at one point, and maybe I was up 140-some percent, and then I rode it all the way back. And eventually, I think it did touch my cost basis very briefly. So it's been a wild ride. But if you look at the overall, you know, CAGR return that I have since I bought it, it's been good. It's been decent. And I've used those times to acquire more. So I think the journey for those has been a little different. But the spinoff dynamic, I think, definitely happened more with Lumine because that started trading. Again, if memory serves, it was like 17 out of the gate. And over the next several weeks, it fell to like 14, you know, just think about that. And then it finished a year over 30. So quite an opportunity that was.
Yeah. So you had these shares of Topicus deposited on the spinoff. And of course, you could have decided to sell those shares, purchase another name in your portfolio, go back and purchase more shares of Constellation. So what was it about Topicus you think that, you know, warranted it deserving a spot in your portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, I'm intrigued by the whole thing. I mean, in some ways, you know, we talk about Constellation 2.0. I mean, Topicus is the next kind of little Constellation. I mean, it's Constellation, but in Europe. And you know, a friend of mine pointed out to me by email that Topicus today is the same size as Constellation was in 2013. So if you roll back then, you'd probably be pretty delighted if you could go back and invest in Constellation in 2013. And I think you have that chance now. I mean, they have a very big fragmented Europe. A big market in Europe, I think, to deploy capital. And it's just the basic underlying algo there is attractive. I mean, you're buying a company that I think should be able to grow at least 25% a year, and they're reinvesting everything. 25% return on invested capital, and they're reinvesting everything. And, you know, you throw in some organic growth and you've got a company that, you know, could compound free cash flow per share 30% a year for years. So that's the basic attraction. And you're doing that in a business without leverage, without, it's not cyclical, it's very sturdy, generates a lot of underlying cash. You've got great incentives, same incentive structure at Constellation carries over to Topicus. You know, you don't have to worry about dilution. Another great thing about Constellation, you know, the share count stays the same. You don't have to worry about necessarily them doing something really dumb with a lot of leverage. You know, so there are ways these companies get in trouble. I think you're pretty safe there with Topicus. So that's the appeal. And it's a little smaller. So like we said, the runway in theory should be greater.
And in doing my research on Topicus, it seems that the private equity market in Europe is less developed, which potentially leads to less competition for the likes of Topicus in terms of these acquisitions. And then another piece I thought interesting was that Europe seems to be a pretty fragmented market where you have, you know, one niche in France, another, the same niche in Italy, and you have two different companies operating within that. So it's difficult for companies to cross borders, I should say, or maybe more difficult than, say, the United States, for example. Is there anything that you maybe don't like as much with Topicus relative to the other two?
Well, I mean, if I had a complaint about Topicus, it would be, I wish they could be a little more accessible, let's say. I'd love to see Robin, the CEO, write an annual letter to shareholders, you know, kind of giving us the lay of the land from his point of view. You know, I think in general, I think sometimes the complexity of Topicus keeps shareholders away. And there's kind of a little bit of a bar you got to get over. If you're not familiar already with Constellation, there's kind of this kind of bar you got to get. It's almost like Mark has designed it so that there's this hurdle you got to get over to be a shareholder. You know, it's not so easy. And I guess it kind of works because it attracts a certain kind of shareholder, right? You know, you're not going to get someone who's just looking to make a quick trade because you have to put so much work in understanding it. You know, there's some accounting things that have been bizarre, you know, the way the deals have been structured. And like I say, you don't get a quarterly earnings call. You know, management's not doing road shows. They don't have a nice little presentation. All these things investors love to digest. You get a very simple, you know, public disclosures. And then Robin participates in the annual meeting that Constellation has. And sometimes, you know, there are questions put his way, but you don't get a lot. And management doesn't really talk to investors. So these are kind of the hurdles and things that if I, you know, could change a little bit about Topicus, I would go in that direction. You know, I don't think they have to go so far as to hold quarterly calls or do that, but I would like to see maybe Topicus hold their own annual meeting or, you know, or like I said, an annual letter from the shareholder, CEO to shareholders. So if I had to say what I didn't like about it, it would be along those lines.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Clay Fink. Before I became a host on We Study Billionaires, I hosted one of our other podcasts called Millennial Investing. Kyle Grieve and Patrick Donnelly have done an incredible job now hosting that show and taking it to the next level. For example, Kyle recently hosted an amazing episode with Chris Mayer on episode 310 that gave a masterclass on serial acquirers. Serial acquirers are a very interesting business model with very strong multi-bagger potential. This makes them potentially the dream business for stock pickers like us. Kyle also hosted some other amazing episodes packed full of timeless investing wisdom with guests like Lawrence Cunningham, Robert Hagstrom, and Brian Feraldi. Millennial Investing, along with We Study Billionaires, is definitely one you should add to your arsenal of top podcasts. Check it out today by searching for Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and clicking the follow button. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. but I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? For me, nothing beats having my next flight free thanks to NerdWallet. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
What's also quite interesting about Topic is the organic growth rates being higher of the companies they're purchasing. Is this a strategic play in terms of the European market, or why do you think they're approaching it a bit differently of looking for higher organic growth?
Yeah, I mean, this part of the original appeal of Topicus is that they had this higher organic growth, and it is higher. I mean, it's probably run like, 6 to 8% and higher when you look at, it's higher, 6 to 8. And I would say like the maintenance recurring, the key piece is probably 8 to 9. And I think in third quarter, hit 11. So, I mean, it's the model works better. It's easier when you have that organic growth, right? It's just kind of the math. It makes it easier to compound when you already start with your base assets are going 10% a year or whatever. So that's always been part of the appeal. And why that is, I think Mark Leonard's talked about that. It's one of the things they want to learn more from Topicus, how they achieve that organic growth. I think it comes down to being focused on it. We've talked already a lot about incentives on this interview, but from my understanding is Constellation's incentives, you get paid for, deploying capital, making deals, and at least traditionally, you haven't been so much paid to create organic growth, because create organic growth requires attention and expense. And when you look at it, it's maybe not the best focus for that management team. But Topicus has figured out a way to do it. So it'll be interesting to see if they can keep that up. And if some of that knowledge base transfers over to Constellation, I think maybe some of it has. I would be curious to hear what Mark says on that, because the Constellation's organic growth, as we've talked about earlier, has I think been pretty strong, stronger than most people would probably have guessed, 5% plus in the last few quarters of last year.
Let's turn to Lumine now. This one's also different, just like Topicus is a little bit different. This was the 2023 spinoff. It was merged with Wide Orbit. So Lumine seems to be doing fewer volumes of acquisitions, and they're doing larger deals, and they don't have a wide range of verticals they can go into. They just have one vertical they're getting into, which is the media and communications. So Lumine is another one that, you got the shares and presumably added to them. So I'd like for you to talk about this one as well.
Yeah, I mean, when I first looked at Lumine, and I remember talking to, David Nyland, the CEO, and he, kind of trying to suss out what the differences would be, how Lumine would be different maybe than Constellation. And one of the things that appealed to me about it was this idea that Lumine would have a heavier weight or tilt towards carve-outs. Now, I know that's not the technical definition of a carve-out, what they're doing, but that's the kind of language they use, is when they buy a subsidiary, kind of an orphan from a much larger company, like they did with Nokia. And that was the deal that really put rocket fuel in the share price at the end of the year there, last year. So I like that. And I like that because there's a lot less competition to do that. There's a lot more technical skills and things involved in doing those kinds of deals. So there's not as much competition. And so I thought that would also lead to high returns. And David and his team have done this. So they know what to do. So actually the way it's played out is kind of the way I thought it might, which is you wouldn't see deals for a little while. And then all of a sudden they would do something kind of sizable and interesting. And I think that's kind of what we should expect from Lumine. So it's really interesting because it's Constellation, it has the same incentives and, the reporting is the same. So it's very similar, feels familiar, but then they have this different tilt or bent, they have the specific vertical, larger deals, carve outs. I think that's very attractive. And they have a lot of room. One of the things I've heard sometimes when I talk to people about Lumine earlier is they're like, it seems like it's confined to one vertical and not as attractive, but it's an enormous vertical. And when you talk to them, David, about what kind of pipeline they have, I mean, we're talking about low thousands is their pipeline, and they're in touch with companies in the low hundreds. So again, this is Lumine owns less than 30 businesses today. So a lot of room, a lot of space to grow. And so I thought it was a really appealing setup and worth having its own real estate in the portfolio.
With that spinoff in the acquisition of Wide Orbit, they paid $497 million. And from what I've researched or picked up, it seems like they paid around 11 to 12 times EBIT, which doesn't seem like Constellation to pay that sort of multiple, but it does have a strong organic growth rate. In 2021, its organic growth was 10%. Have you thought about whether they've taken a lower hurdle rate in this deal, or what have you found on this front?
Yeah, the deal, it's higher than what you would see typically for a CSI deal. But Wide Orbit is a very good business. They've got tremendous pricing power. I mean, it's a business that's involved with advertising for radios and TV stations, and it's not something you can rip out. I mean, it's really mission critical and functional to those businesses. So I suspect that, you know, because I know just culturally within CSI how they cling to those hurdle rates, I don't think that they lowered their hurdle rate on this deal. I suspect that they will get there, or they must see a path to get there. And my suspicion is that it's in that pricing power and the stickiness of that business. So, you know, we'll have to see. But I think it looks like a very good deal.
And I could see one potential advantage for Lumine is the potential synergies within the subsidiaries. I had found some notes that one company that sold to Lumine did so they could learn operational best practices, meet industry peers, and look at natural synergies and complementary product offerings. So this seems to not be as big of a priority for the Constellation Software or Topicus, but maybe more so an opportunity for Lumine.
Yeah, could be. I mean, I also think that, you know, you look at media and communications, and there's a lot of these older media and communications that are not really growing. And so in that sense, it's a very target rich environment for a CSI type mentality to come in and redeploy those cash flows. So I think that's part of the appeal there as well. You know, the other interesting thing is about Lumine is that David Nolan and his team, they have sourced all their own deals. At least, you know, up to the time when I talked to them, maybe the last couple of deals, maybe this isn't true. But I mean, I think there's quite a bit of talent in that team also that I think plays into it.
And Lumine is generally doing deals that are a bit larger. Do you expect the return on capital to be similar for them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is another thing where, you know, again, like we talked about before, the larger deals in theory are going to have lower IRR. So, but, you know, Lumine are doing these sort of quirky one-off deals. So it may surprise us. I mean, we'll have to wait and see. But I suspect with Lumine, you're still going to get, you know, 25% type returns on capital in that business. You know, maybe even better with some of these.
And one aspect that is probably pretty intriguing is sort of the copy and paste format. For example, the incentive structure carrying over from Constellation to Topicus to Lumine. Have you seen that incentive structure overall carry over one-to-one essentially?
Yeah, it's the same. And, you know, that's part of the big appeal too. You know, so they're not handing out stock options and the comp is the same. So it's something like, you know, 75% of the CEO's bonus is used to purchase shares. And then those shares are locked up for, you know, 3 to 5 years. So I've always really liked that about Constellation. When I think about, you know, incentive structure in my portfolio companies, Constellation is the number one, the gold standard. And then the spinoffs are the same. So yeah, that's a big part of the appeal. That's exactly the kind of things they focus on, are the kind of things we focus on as investors, which is, you know, returns on capital and growth. And that's what we want.
I also wanted to talk about the valuations. I had spoke with a member of our investment community that manages a fund, and he was sharing some of the information he had on these companies, and he owned all three. He was kind enough to share with me the analyst expectations that he had for these companies for 2024. You know, take analyst expectations with a grain of salt, but it just sort of points to what people are expecting. So the multiple, this is from mid-January, so prices change day to day. But just to give you a general direction, he shared a multiple of 36 on 2024 earnings for Constellation, a multiple of 32 for Topicus, and then 32 for Lumine as well. So the market seems to be putting a bit of a premium on Constellation. They're probably much more well-known and a lot more investors probably know about them. And it seems a little bit counterintuitive given Constellation's size that they would be trading at a higher multiple. So maybe you could just share your thoughts on their current valuations in light of everything we've talked about, in light of, you know, the quality, the management teams and such.
Well, I mean, taking those numbers at face value is 36 and 32. To me, that's kind of in the realm of the error, rounding error. So I don't know that it would be that much different. I also think that if you're a long-term investor in these, then, you know, the exact multiple maybe will fade in importance a little bit. And the way I think about it is I always think about things kind of like 10-year commitments. You know, you look out and, you know, the basic math of it is if it's 25%, let's just say if it's 25% CAGR over 10 years, that's 9x. You know, think about that. 9x. So suddenly, and it doesn't have to be that number, you know, make it, if it's 20%, it's, I think it's six something. So suddenly, whether it's trading for 25 or 30 or 35 kind of doesn't take on as much of, if you knew that it was going to be nine times higher, or let's say earnings were going to be nine times higher 10 years from now, you know, then I think, you're not so much worried about whether you're paying 32 or 35 or 29. So that's the frame of reference. Obviously, you can't pay 50. You know, you can't pay crazy multiples, but you have more room than you think with some of these. And then even so, if you wait, you almost always get chances. I mean, we talked about it. I mean, Lumine briefly hit, you know, got down to 17 handle in, I think it was October. And it finished the year over 30. So that's dramatic. You might not get quite that swing, but for all these companies, you're going to get some chances. So there's two different ways. You know, I always say, like, if you love a company, you've done all the work. And for me, you know, the hurdle rates are high for me to find something. So if I find something, I'll start small, even if it's trading at 31 or 32, 35. And then you can always build it up. But up later. But the problem is, if you wait too much, sometimes, you know, it might go a year or two before you really get a shot. And then you would have been better off just buying it when you first wanted to buy it. So I don't get too, you know, I don't put too fine of a point on, you know, what the multiple is to that extent. You know, the way I think about it is just a very simple model of, you know, they have so much capital today, they're earning a return on that capital. You forecast that out, how much are they going to reinvest of what they make? And you kind of, you know, you get a number 10 years out, put a multiple on that. What's your IRR? So you've got quite a bit of room to play around with those variables and adjust them along the way. But I think these are pretty attractive to own over a 10-year period of time.
I love that you just kind of showcase the example of 25% over 10 years is a 9x in the earnings potential. And I was actually on a call with our community yesterday talking about this idea of paying up for quality. And I wanted to tie in the numbers and share just something very similar to what you did. You know, I don't think enough people probably do this because they probably think 25% consistently isn't likely, or it's going to be just extremely difficult to do. So what I did is I spanned it out over 5 years and I said, what multiple could you pay today to get a 10% return? And then, you know, say you sell at a multiple of 25. Well, many people would be surprised to hear that you could pay a multiple of 47 and get a 10% return over that period. And there's a few assumptions there that are baked in. So one, a Constellation has had return on capital over 25% over its tenure today. So that's, you know, if you would have modeled out Constellation 5 years ago, you would be underestimating its growth. And then you're also underestimating the terminal multiple. So you're getting much higher returns in that example. And to your point, you know, looking out over 10 years, you know, that just lengthens your returns and, you know, increases your returns over time if you have that longer time horizon as well.
Yeah. I mean, this is the great secret of long-term investing in high quality businesses is that the compounding is amazing. I mean, when you work it out in a spreadsheet, you can do 20%, 25%, whatever you want over 5 and 10 years and see what those numbers are. And then you can kind of love what you did, you know, backing the multiple. I do that too all the time. I remember I did that for my investors in Copart. My investors in my fund, I used Copart, and I think it was 2022 because I went back to 2012. And I said, you know, what multiple could you have paid back in 2012 and earned at least, you know, I don't remember if it was 10 or 15% return that I used. And the multiple was really high. It was like 60 some times you could have paid and still gotten, you know, 15% return on your money. That's what it was. And at the time it was trading for 25. So Terry Smith does this too, you know, his letters, he'll look back at some of these great compounders and say, you know, what you could have paid, what the multiple could have been, and you still gotten a market return. And it's always a surprisingly high number. Now you have to be a little careful with that, right? You can't just willy-nilly start paying big multiples and thinking that you're going to get bailed out. But there are some companies that, you know, you do the work on it and you get conviction that they can repeat their formula over 5 and 10 year periods of time, then it should work out. And you collect enough of those, right? It's not like you have to make one bet. You can create a portfolio. You get 10 of these kinds of businesses. And that's the other thing. When you do it on a portfolio basis, you're doing 10 of them. How many do you really need to work out just like you think? It's you know, you get a couple, you're going to be very happy, especially if you let them just run and you don't cut back and trim your winners all the time, which is what another thing people tend to do, to sabotage their returns.
Yeah. And I think it's also important not to chase things, you know, chase something that's gone up in price, you know, say, hey, I'm paying up for quality. It's a long-term compounder because, you know, you mentioned 2023, a lot of these companies are very choppy.
40, 50% differences between the high, you know, it's a lot, and just within 1 year. So, and these are among the highest quality companies around. So yeah, you're going to get chances.
I'm curious, if you were given fresh capital today, how would you think about allocating it? You don't have to say Constellation topic it, like, you know, you have 11 holdings. So how would you generally think about putting it to work?
Well, like, first, I think about position sizing. So sometimes, like, I don't mind using Constellation here. I probably wouldn't add to it if I got fresh capital, only because it's my number one position now, and I think it's probably 12 or 13%. So whereas certain other positions are a lower percentage and perhaps, you know, just as attractive. So some of it is, you know, position sizing kind of guides where that fresh capital goes, but then also looking out on that sort of 10-year model that we looked at, where is the most attractive place to put it. And there's always, you know, a couple that stand out as obvious places that I would put it that are well below kind of my thresholds on position sizing, because there's some guardrails that I put in place for myself. You know, I don't like to necessarily push anything above 10% with capital. I'm perfectly happy letting it compound. And if, you know, gets to a bigger number, great, totally willing to do that. But as I get inflows, I don't like to push things above 10. So my positions tend to be kind of right now, because the fund's still relatively young, it's only 5 years. The span between kind of these positions are like, you know, 8 to 12, kind of in that range. It's not like I have 15%, 20% position, and then I have 4 or 5, 3% positions. I don't have that. So to answer your question, I mean, that's the way I would think about it. First, just kind of looking at the position sizing and then kind of gauging attractiveness from there. And then, you know, it doesn't bother me to hold cash for a while. If I, you know, sit on cash for 5 or 6 months while I think about it, it's okay.
When I look at the stock chart for Constellation, I can't help but draw parallels to something like Microsoft in 1999. I think Microsoft is like a 60 PE or something. I mentioned a forward multiple for Constellation of 36. Is there ever a point where you'd trim it back if it, you know, became too big of a position in the portfolio, or the valuation felt a little bit uncomfortable?
Well, as a general rule, I don't trim. So it would have to be like really egregious. So that's number one. And even then, I mean, Topicus, you could argue, got pretty egregious in 2021. And I never sold it. But that's also because I didn't necessarily have anything else that I was pounding on my, you know, anything else that I was really wanting to buy. So, you know, sometimes it's dictated by what other opportunities there are. If I had something today that was like screaming buy that I have to own, you know, I have to give some hard thought to whether I wanted to trim something else or where I would get the capital. Because right now I'm fully invested, and I've been fully invested for a while. I mean, cash is less than 1%. So it's not like I have room to do anything right now other than sell something first. So all these considerations come into play. But in the general rule, I think the source of outperformance comes from an investor's willingness to let something become a bigger part of their portfolio, let them really ride those winners. And if you do get something that, you know, the ideal would be you get something that sort of takes over, you know, and you look at it and it's 20, 25% of your portfolio, and it's just kind of gone up 20x and you're delighted, you know. So that's kind of how I think about it.
It's funny. There's a few people I don't know personally, just see them on Twitter post their portfolios, and Constellation's become an outsized portion because they've never sold a share. I also wanted to mention that you had a great conversation with my co-host, Kyle Grieve, on our Millennial Investing Show. You talked all about serial acquirers, and that's sort of a bigger theme in your portfolio. We didn't talk really too much about Technion or Lifco or Heiko, and those are also in your portfolio. So if people would like to learn more about the serial acquirer model, I would point them to that episode that I'll be sure to link in the show notes. And for those in our audience, Chris, who would like to learn more about serial acquirers, other than referencing that episode, is there any other resources you would point to?
My friends at InPractice have done a lot of good work on the serial acquirers. That's a paid subscription, but they have a lot of stuff on all the names we've talked about, serial acquirers. So that would be one. Definitely recommend that. You know, there's a free site called acquirers.com. You can check that out. There's a I think there's a free book there that gives kind of a overview of the serial acquirer model. So I'd recommend that. You know, my friend over at Oddbjorn over at REQ Capital, they've just released within the last, couple months, a huge mammoth 300-page slide deck on serial acquirers. So I'd definitely recommend that. So yeah, those should definitely, that's enough to chew on for anybody there. I would say those things start there.
Wonderful. Well, Chris, always enjoy having you on the show. Feels like such a privilege to have an opportunity to chat with you and sort of pick your brain on some of these things. I want to give you a final handoff. For those in the audience who want to learn more about you and what you're up to do, please point them to any resources you'd like.
Sure. Well, thank you, Clay. It's always good to be on. You always agree because we have good conversations. You ask good questions. So I enjoy it as well. Yeah. I mean, if people want to find me, Woodlock House Family Capital is the name of my firm. And I write a very occasional blog and I haven't really written it in a while, I know. But there's a lot of stuff on there to read from the past. And I'm still active on, we used to be Twitter and now X. And not as much, but I still will post things occasionally there. So those are two ways to keep up with what I'm doing.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Chris. And I'm excited to watch the Constellation story play out over the next 10 years and see how it ends up.
Yep. Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to follow We Study Billionaires on your favorite podcast app and never miss out on episodes. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.